The following program is pre-recorded.
A Jerry Pippen Conspiracy Files Special Report.
President's car is now turning onto Elm Street, and it will be only a matter of minutes before he arrives at the trademark.
A presidential assassination. Almost a half century later, we may have the answer to who killed JFK. It appears at least we will be knowing soon exactly who Jacqueline Kennedy thinks did it. A decision has been made, according to Globe magazine, by daughter Caroline Kennedy. An article in this week's magazine says that Caroline is evidently going to be releasing a book on the subject. It will come out in September. It contains some highly edited disclosures made by her mother shortly after the assassination in 1964 to historian Arthur Schlesinger. The source in Globe magazine says that Jacqueline implicates FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover. We are not sure about President Lyndon Johnson. Many, including conspiracy author friends of mine, James Fetzer and Jim Mars, have long been indicating President Lyndon Johnson as part of the plot. It's not clear whether we'll know Jacqueline's thinking on this subject at all. These top-secret tapes of Jacqueline Kennedy were not supposed to be released until 2039, long after everyone implicated in the murder is dead. On the question of J. Edgar Hoover and President Lyndon Baines Johnson and the Kennedy murder, we're going to play a tape now. It's been around for a while, in which President Johnson is talking to J. Edgar Hoover on the phone about the investigation. Listen carefully and see if you think this is a ruse, or is it a genuine conversation between the two men. As I've already said, some of my investigative author friends seem to think that this whole thing was made up, a kind of untasteful theater to throw the controversy buffs off their trail. Let's listen, and you tell me what you think.
This angle in Mexico is giving us a great deal of trouble because the stories I have, this man, Oswald, getting $6,500 from the Cuban embassy and then coming back to this country with it. We're not able to prove that fact. The information was that he was there on the 18th of September in Mexico City, and we are able to prove conclusively he was in New Orleans that day. Now, then they changed the date. The story came in, changing the date to the 28th of September, and he was in Mexico City on the 28th. Now, the Mexican police have again arrested this woman, Duran, who's a member of the Cuban embassy, and will hold her for 2-3 more days. And we've got to confront her with the original informant who stole the money pass, so he says, and we're also going to put the lie detector test on him. Meantime, of course, Capshaw's hollering his head off.
Can you pay attention to those lie detector tests?
I would not pay 100% attention to them. All that they are is a psychological asset in an investigation. I wouldn't want to be a part of sending a man to the chair on a lie detector. For instance, we have found many cases where we've used them and in a bank where there's been embezzlement, and a person will confess before the lie detector test is finished. They're more or less fearful of the fact that the lie detector test will show them guilty. Psychologically, they have that advantage because it's a misnomer to call it a lie detector, because what it really is, it's the evaluation of the chart that is made by this machine. And that evaluation is made by a human being. And any human being can be apt to make a wrong interpretation. So I would not myself go on that alone. If, on the other hand, if this fellow Oswald had lived and had taken me out of the lie detector test and it had shown definitely that he had done these various things, together with the evidence that we very definitely have, it would have just added that much more strength to it. There's no question but that he is the man. Now, the fingerprints and things that we have. lie detector test, but his lawyer's got to be cross-consulted first, and I doubt whether the lawyer will allow him. He's one of these criminal lawyers from the West Coast, and somewhat like an Edward Bennett Williams type, and almost as much of a shyster.
Mm-hmm. Have you got any relationship between the two here?
Between Rubenstein?
Yeah.
No, at the present time, we have not. There was a story down there that...
Were you ever in his bar?
There was a story that this fellow had been in this nightclub, this strip tease joint that he has, but that has not been able to be confirmed. Now, this fellow Rubenstein is a very shady character, has a bad record, street brawler, fighter, and that sort of thing. And in the place in Dallas, if a fellow came in there and couldn't pay his bill completely, Rubenstein would beat the very devil out of him and throw him out of the place. He was that kind of a fella. He didn't drink, didn't smoke, boasted about that. He's what I would put in the category, one of his egomaniacs. He likes to be in the limelight. He knew all the police in that white light district where the joints are in there. And he also let them come in, see the show, get food, and get liquor, and so forth. That's how I think he got into police headquarters. Because they accepted him as kind of a police character hanging around police headquarters. And for that reason, raised no question. Of course, they never made any moves as the pictures show, even when they saw him approaching this fella, and got up right to him and pressed his pistol against Oswald's stomach. Neither of the police officers on either side made any move to push him away or to grab him. It wasn't until after the gun was fired that they then moved. Now, of course, that is not the highest degree of efficiency, so to say. Secondly, the chief of police admits that he moved him in the morning as a convenience and at the request of the motion picture people who wanted to have daylight. He should have moved him at night, but he didn't. And, those derelictions in that phase. But so far as tying Rubenstein and Oswald together, we haven't as yet done so. There have been a number of stories come in. We've tied Oswald into the Civil Liberties Union in New York, membership into that, and of course into this Cuban Fair Play Commission committee, which was pro-Castro and dominated by communism and financed to some extent by the Castro government.
How many shots were fired?
Three.
Any of them fired at me?
No, there was
all three at the president.
All three at the president, and we have them. Two of the shots fired at the president were splintered, but they had characteristics on them so that our ballistic expert was able to prove that they were fired by this gun. The third shot, which hit the president, he was hit by the first and the third. The second shot hit the governor. The third shot is a complete bullet that wasn't shattered, and that rolled out of the president's head. It tore a large part of the president's head off, and in trying to massage his heart at the hospital, on the way to the hospital, they apparently loosened that and that fell onto the stretcher. And we recovered that. And we have that. And we have the gun here also.
Were they aiming at the president?
They were aiming directly at the president. There's no question about that. This telescopic lens that I've looked through, it brings the person as close to you as if they were sitting right beside you. And we also have tested the fact that you could fire, those three shots were fired within 3 seconds. There have been some stories going around in the papers and so forth that there must have been more than one man, but of course no one man could fire those shots from the time that they were fired. We've just proved that by the actual test that we've made.
How did it happen? They hit Connally.
Connally turned to the president when the first shot was fired. And I think in that turning it was where he got hit.
If he hadn't turned, he probably wouldn't have got hit.
I think that's very likely.
And the president got hit second.
No, the president wasn't hit with the second one.
I see if Connally hadn't been in his way.
Oh, yes. The president no doubt would have been hit.
He'd been hit three times.
He'd been hit three times. You know, on the fifth floor of that building where we found the gun and the wrapping paper in which the gun was wrapped, and upon which we find the full fingerprints of this man Oswald, on that floor, we found the three empty shells that had been fired, and one shell that had not been fired. In other words, there were four shells apparently, and he had fired three, but didn't fire the fourth one. He then threw the gun aside, came down, and at the entrance of the building, he was stopped by a police officer, and some manager in the building told the police officer, well, he's all right, he works for you, you needn't hold him. So they let him go. That's how he got out. Mm-hmm. And then he got on a bus, the bus driver has identified him, and went out to his home, and got hold of a jacket that he wanted for some purpose, and came back downtown, walking downtown, and the police officer who was killed stopped him, not knowing who he was, and not knowing whether he was the man, but they were just on suspicion, and he fired, of course, and killed the police officer. Then he walked
about... You can prove that.
Oh, yes, we can prove that. Then he walked about another two blocks and went to the theater, and the woman at the theater window selling the tickets, she was so suspicious of the way he was acting, and she said he was carrying a gun. He had a revolver at that time, with which he had killed the police officer. He went into the theater, and then she notified the police, and the police and our man down there went in there and located this particular man. He had quite a struggle with him. He fought like a regular lion, and he had to be subdued, of course, and his brother was then brought out, of course, taken to the police headquarters. But he apparently had come down the five flights of steps stairway from the fifth floor. So far as we found out, the elevator was not used, although he could have used it, but nobody remembers whether it was or whether it wasn't.
Well, your conclusion is that he's the one that did it. B's man is after was arrested. C would have hit him three times except the other turn.
I think that's correct.
Four, that there's no connection between he and Ruby that you can detect now. And five, whether he was connected with the Cuban operation with money you were trying to...
That's what we're trying to nail down now. Because he was strongly pro-Castro. He was strongly anti-American. And he had been in correspondence, which we have, with the Soviet embassy here in Washington, and with the American Civil Liberties Union, and with this committee for fair play to Cuba. We have copies of the correspondence. So we've got it nailed down in his contact with them. None of those letters, however, dealt with any indication of violence or contemplated assassination. They were dealing with the matter of a visa for his wife to go back to Russia.
That was a phone call made on November 29th, 5 days after Lee Harvey Oswald was shot and killed in the Dallas police station by Jack Rubenstein, known locally as Jack Ruby. It is known that Jacqueline was convinced that the FBI boss J. Edgar Hoover did it and not Lee Harvey Oswald. She agreed with Oswald's statement, I'm a patsy.
I work in that building.
Were you in the building at the time?
Naturally, if I work in that building, yes, sir.
Back up, man.
Come on, man.
No, they're taking me in because of the fact that I live in the Soviet Union. I'm just a patsy.
Mrs. Kennedy thought Hoover was the mastermind of the crime, and it was carried out by his most trusted and loyal agents. At least that is what the source is telling Globe magazine in this article released this weekend. The source said that Mrs. Kennedy was terrified to push for a new investigation. She feared that the killers would target her and her children. According to the source, Jackie felt that Hoover and his group was very unhappy with President Kennedy and his brother Bobby. Mrs. Kennedy was not alone in believing that Hoover was an integral part of the plot to slay her husband. Then there was Jack Ruby. He silenced Lee Harvey Oswald. At a press conference, Ruby came as close as you can come to saying that he was ordered to do it by a higher authority.
What's happening has never come to the surface. The world will never know the true facts of what occurred, my motives. The people that had so much to gain and had such an ulterior motive for putting me in a position I'm in.
Interestingly enough, on this point that J. Edgar Hoover was making with Lyndon Johnson on the phone 5 days after Oswald was killed, was loosely correct. Everybody seems to agree to that. Even two authors who come from different areas, Jim Moore, who wrote a book called Conspiracy of One that's been out of print since 1995,
on the thesis that Oswald did it all, actually says that
I
hate to give Hoover any credit at all. And Jim Mars wrote me an email. He says, in my book, Crossfire, beginning on page 350, I talk about this. And let me read it, folks. Shoe store salesman Johnny Brewer saw a man acting suspiciously and walking near the entrance to the Texas Theater. He then walked into the theater. Brewer then walked over to the theater but could not see the man. He then asked the ticket sales girl, Julia Postal, if a man had just bought a ticket and entered, and she said no. The assistant manager, Butch Burroughs, said he heard the man come through the front door but never made it to the ticket area where he was to take his ticket. In between there, there was a set of stairs that went up to the balcony, and Butch assumed that's where the man went. He instructed Julia, the ticket seller, to call the police. Someone had sneaked in, and he and Brewer waited for the cops. When they arrived, they turned on the house lights, even though the movie was still running, and Brewer and some officers went up on the stage, where Brewer pointed to the back of the theater. Now, I've talked to Jim Mars about this in great detail, and it appears to Jim, and I must say it makes sense, that the cops just didn't rush back to arrest Lee Harvey Oswald. They came off the stage and went back row by row by row until they got to where Oswald was, the third row back from the back, in the third seat. Now, the interesting thing that happens next is that Oswald doesn't run. And Mars has pointed out to me many times, maybe this was what went wrong. Maybe they thought they were going to be able to eliminate Lee Harvey Oswald there in the theater. And when he was approached by Officer N. Elmham McDonald, was heard saying, this is it, and began grappling with McDonald, who then says that Oswald pulled a pistol, stuck it into his stomach, and pulled the trigger. But the gun just snapped. The FBI would later say the firing pin was bent, making the gun inoperable. Interesting little sidelight here. Jim Moore, I asked him tonight if he had changed his mind since he had written that book, Conspiracy of One, and he said no. He hadn't seen any evidence to change his mind. And I asked Jim Mars about that once, since he wrote Crossfire, if he had changed his mind on any of the things he wrote about in that book. And he said...
No, that's interesting. My book, Crossfire, which is a basis for the Oliver Stone movie, JFK, which caused such controversy in the early 90s, was actually published in the 80s. And that was based on information that I had years when I began teaching a course on the Kennedy assassination at the University of Texas at Arlington back in 1976. And at that time, the conclusion was, and my classes have all agreed to this after reviewing all the evidence, that number one, yes, there was a conspiracy. Number two, if Oswald even acted within that conspiracy, and that's a big if, he didn't really shoot anybody, and that the whole case has been covered up at the highest levels of the federal government of the United States, which is what elevates what at that time was simply a Texas homicide to a national coup d'etat.
Interesting that we had three Jims involved in the Kennedy assassination tonight, all well-known authors. The third Jim is Jim Fetzer. Jim Fetzer, of course, Professor James H. Fetzer is his correct title. Jim quotes a letter from Evelyn Lincoln, who was JFK's personal secretary, when a teacher wrote her and asked her who she thought killed JFK. She states that she thought there were five conspirators: J. Edgar Hoover, the Mafia, the CIA, Lyndon B. Johnson, and the Cubans in Florida. Now, Jim Mars also says he has a copy of this letter. Evelyn Lincoln evidently wrote it to a school teacher when she asked about it, about the assassination and who did it. A copy of that letter, dated 1994, 7 October, can be found on page 372 of James Fetzer's book, Assassination Science, which was published in 1998. Jim Mars brought up an interesting point to me tonight by email, and that is, why did not Evelyn Lincoln give any major media interviews? Did no one ask her? Or what? An interesting question. So to wrap up the latest developments, it's believed now that Jacqueline Kennedy has 6.5 hours of audio tapes in which Jackie will be talking about all of the things surrounding the presidency, including the assassination, and it'll all be in her own words. Now, it will be at least some of the edited portions will be in Caroline Kennedy's new book. But I understand also that perhaps they're going to actually release the audio tapes by Jackie herself. Mrs. Kennedy, evidently in these tapes in the interview, names the people who she thinks were responsible for her husband's murder. The source in the Globe indicates that Caroline's not going to allow that to be released, that part of it. Hopefully that'll change. I think the public has a right to know. They should not have been sitting on it all this time, in my opinion. J. Edgar Hoover's been long dead, so if that's who they thought did it, or Lyndon Johnson, he's been long dead. So who are they afraid of? Well, there may be still some out there that we don't know about. In these tapes, evidently, other things were discussed, including her husband's infidelity, and even their last night together, which I understand was pretty steamy, at least the Globe says. But, of course, what would you expect the Globe to say? The source for the Globe says, these tapes are blockbusters. They could change the shape of American history. Now, the audio tapes were recorded in 7 different sessions with Jacqueline, and they did the interviews in Washington, D.C. in 1964. So this has been a report on breaking news of a murder that occurred in 1963. The assassination of President John Kennedy. I'd like to thank everyone for helping us out with the show tonight. Jane Swartley has been our producer. I'm Jerry Pippin. Until next time, cheers.